Chasing Giants with Don Higgins and Terry Peer. Brought to you by Osseo Camo, nature's most lethal camouflage. Follow along as Don and Terry discuss the techniques, strategies, and dedication needed to harvest one of God's most amazing creations, world-class whitetails.
Welcome, everyone, to the Chasing Giants podcast brought to you by Osseo Gear with Don Higgins. I'm Terry Peer. This is episode 285 on August 9th. How's it going, Don? What'd you get into this week?
Well, I checked a lot of cameras this week, Terry, looking for a giant shooter buck, which I have not yet found. But that and working around the farm, lots of mowing I had to do. So did a little bit of spraying of weeds. This time of the year, you know, those weeds are at their final push before they put seed on, so that they have a late growth spurt. I'm trying to get them before they put that seed head on, and just working around the farm.
Yep. We're going to talk about a bunch of different topics on this podcast. We have a special habit. You and I both are doing a habitat project this month, which is actually really rare for us to do one this late that we want to talk about. I got mine done. You're going to do yours in just a day or two. Josh Anderson's on the way up to film it. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about preparing for food plots for the fall, because social media is filling up with everybody planting their food plots already. As usual, it happens every year. But Don, the main topic in this first segment that has kind of got everybody a little bit on cringe is we got reports of some EHD this week in a couple different places.
Yeah, my business partner owns a property in Southeast Ohio, and he found some in the creek and in the pond, and the neighbor on the neighboring property to him had found several as well. So it's hitting hard there. And you know, it's a little bit early, but I heard a couple of reports a month ago, and it's really early this year. But you know, the thing that strikes me is everybody says that it's worse in dry years, because in dry years, the water sources have dried up and the deer are concentrated around fewer water sources. And those midge gnats come in, you know, lay their limited water sources, and then the deer come to drink, and that's where they get infected. I've always wondered if that was true, and I think this year is proving that it's not true. My theory is, on a wet year, like this has been a pretty wet year in a lot of the country, and on a wet year, there's just more mud. There's mud everywhere. I mean, there's mud puddles. There's the ponds and the creeks that are normally there, and I don't buy that it's worse in dry years. It can be really bad in dry years, no doubt about it. We've seen that in the past. 2012, when we had our worst outbreak ever, was the worst drought that I've ever seen ever. So there may be something to that, but I've also seen it in years like this where it's fairly wet and there's still a lot of outbreaks. But the thing about this year is how early these outbreaks are hitting. In 2012, when it hit, that was the year that I went to Alaska. I'll never forget that year because we had the worst drought of my entire life, and that's the year I went to Alaska. So that 2012 is kind of one of those years that I remember well. When I went to Alaska, I didn't leave until 1st of September. And when I left, EHD was just starting to hit and in my area. Here we are a month before that, pretty much, and we're getting EHD hitting. So totally different situation this year.
I think there's just so much to it that we will never understand, to be honest with you. I mean, we have some of the best nutritionists, biologists, you know, that we've teamed up with over the years. And I think there's more questions than answers, to be honest with you. Maybe I'm wrong, but you know, last year it's just so, there's usually mass breakouts. There's pocket breakouts. You mentioned Southeast Ohio. I heard Switzerland County, Indiana had some. I haven't talked to anyone personally that's found deer. That was all secondhand. I guess comment down below if you've heard about it. But man, it's like we want to draw these conclusions to what happens and find root cause analysis to this. But I don't think there's any if, ands, or wins, honestly. I think that where we have to focus on is keeping the health of the herd as high as we can. however we can based on the game laws in that state to fight it. The healthier we can keep these deer, the better nutrition that we're putting in them, the better chance we have to do it. I mean, well, your place last year is a perfect example. You had no signs of it, but 30 miles away on my farm, 80% of the deer were dead.
Yeah, and, you know, the question I've been getting recently is what can we do about it? I mean, you know, we probably was one of the first companies, Real World was one of the first companies to come out with a product with our Expect Healthy Deer technology. And I do believe that Expect Healthy Deer technology can save some deer. Definitely not 100%, but I do think it can save some deer. But the challenge in that is getting it into the deer ahead of the outbreak and getting enough in those deer on a consistent basis that it's always in their system. And you know, there's been more and more companies try to follow in those footsteps, including there's a new company that's got something that you put in the water, ponds or whatever. I don't know anything about that product, but I suspect it probably works to some degree. What degree, I don't know. But when you start thinking about it, there's a lot of water sources across the, you know, a region, be it cattle ponds or whatever. And yeah, a land manager who owns his land primarily for deer hunting, he can go out and he can treat every water source on his property. But are the farmers, you know, in a mile in every direction around him, are they also treating every stock pond? What about the creeks, the bigger creeks, you know, that are flowing? Is someone going up and down those creeks and treating every bit of that water? Now, again, I think if it was legal in my home state of Illinois, I would be doing everything I could. I'd be feeding them supplemental feed with Expect Healthy Deer technology in it. I would be feeding them the Maximizer Plus mineral with Expect Healthy Deer technology in it. And I would be treating water sources on my farm. I'd be doing everything. I'd probably even be spraying. Back when I had the captive deer, you know, that's a terrible disease for a captive deer farmer. It can wipe out a guy's herd. And I've heard of more than one guy that, you know, would lose 95-98% of his entire herd in one fall to EHD. But these guys were using these foggers like they use in like apple orchards and things to mist their trees with different, you know, insecticides. Fungicides, things like that. These guys with these high dollar deer would have one of those foggers on the back of a small tractor, and twice a day they would drive around their deer pens fogging the area trying to save deer. So, you know, I think everything probably helps to some degree, but I don't think there's anything out there. It's a virus is what it is, and once a deer's got it, it's got to run its course. And some deer do survive EHD. Most do not, but some do. The ones that do are immune to it, and they will pass some immunity on to their fawns. So, you know, in the South, it's been there forever, and the deer are more immune to it down there. I know with the captive deer, I mean, I learned so much from those captive deer that it's just crazy that some of that I can apply to my management and some that I can't. But you take these northern deer from the Midwest or wherever down to Texas, they don't live. They do not survive because of the EHD outbreak every single year. But they've been bringing Texas deer up north to get some EHD resistance, and it provides that. So, you know, again, there's a lot we don't know, but there's a little bit we do know. But the thing that intrigues me is here we are in a wetter year, and we're having these outbreaks a month earlier than we typically would see it. It's setting up for a major, major kill in some areas.
Yeah, I'm like you said, it just doesn't make sense with the beliefs that we've kind of talked about the last few years, with dry years hitting around that early September, you know, the holiday weekend, that's when it mostly happens, and man, we're a month ahead, so... I guess strap up and see. The thing that I think people are so reactionary with everything, and serious land managers are preparing, always preparing ahead of time. And when we're talking about the nutrition and the health benefits of whatever product you're using, and maybe it's a combination of all of them to try to make the best bang for your, you know, to get the most consumption, you know, maybe it's all of these products that are out there. You can't just be reactionary and EHD hit your area and then throw feed out thinking you're going to make a difference. I just don't believe that. You got to be, this has got to be part of your program to prepare for this every year.
Yeah, and preparing, you do it in a couple ways. First of all, you get your deer as healthy as possible by making sure they've got every nutrient, every mineral, vitamin, whatever that they need to not only maximize antler production and fawn production, but to maximize their health and their ability to fight these diseases. And then you use everything you can that's available to throw at it, and you hope for the best. And what gets me is how spotty it can be as well. You know, there'll be a farm that just gets absolutely wiped out, not a single deer makes it. And a mile down the road, literally 1 mile down the road, there's not a dead deer anywhere. And I go back to 2012 again, the worst EHD outbreak we've ever had. I did not find a dead deer anywhere on my farm. And to this day, I have never, ever found a dead EHD deer on my property. And I think that's partially due to the layout where I'm kind of an oasis in a sea of ag fields. So I don't know if it's some of the chemicals that they put on the ag fields that keeps these midge gnats away. I don't know what it is. Now, I will take that back, and I will say that in 2012, I lost some captive deer to EHD. But I did not find a single wild deer.
Interesting. And I don't know if this is a good statement, a bad statement. Fact check it if you want. But we talk a lot about the numbers of deer that are on your farm during the summer is down. After yep. the row crops get picked, then they really come in. So the number of deer, if you look at a population on your farm at any time, when EHD hits, is probably one of the lower deer numbers you have on your property.
And it's even down this year compared to what it has been in past years. And I know we got plenty of deer in my neighborhood, but on my farm specifically, I mean, we shot a bunch of does last year, more than double the number of does last year than we've ever shot here. And those were resident does. I was shooting them early enough before the winter migration, if you will, you know, late in the year when the deer show up for the food and pile into the food sources. Sure. So the deer I shot were local resident deer. And so I knocked that number back a good little bit. And this year, my food plot browse pressure was significantly less than it has been for the last several years. I think I'm going to shoot several more does this year. But I think this year I'm going to wait until the late season. I'm going to get some of those that maybe don't live right here, and I may shoot, you know, a few early, but I'm going to spread that harvest out. Last year I don't think I did any in the late season, and this year I'm going to spread that doe harvest out across a wider window to get resident deer and some of the deer that migrate in.
Yeah, interesting. All right, well, comment down below. Let us know if you've heard of any EHD, if you've had it, where's it at. Let's kind of use the thread below to kind of keep track of where this EHD is spread, and everybody can kind of read the comments below. Again, we've heard of Southeast Ohio and along the river, kind of in Indiana between Cincinnati and Louisville. So we're going to take a quick break, listen to a spot from our presenting sponsor, Osseo Gear, and we'll be right back with the second segment.
Osseo Gear introduces a premium line of bow hunting gear that is unmatched, pairing nature's finest camouflage with the best technological innovations. Osseo Gear brings whitetail bow hunters the gear they need to be the best at their craft. The unique camouflage mimics the intricate feather pattern of North America's greatest predatorial creatures. Designed for invisibility, built for comfort, and engineered for function. Visit OsseoGear.com. That's AsioGear.com to start shopping. Osseo Gear, prepare to be invisible.
All right, folks, thanks for tuning in this week and watching the spot from Osseo. Make sure you check that out, OsseoGear.com. A lot of new products this year. Don, as we kind of prepare, we've talked about FAE, and FAE is not really a partner per se of Chasing Giants, but they are the presenting sponsor of the Midwest Sportsman's Classic, which is the Shipshawana show that we have grown so close to love. We put on a big event there every year at the Legends Roundtable. We kind of indirectly are doing a big project with the Midwest Sportsman's Classic next year, sponsored by FAE. But there's going to be a very exclusive seminar about projects going on yours and I's property this year. I've already filmed mine. FAE was on my property the last 2 days. They're coming to you here in the next day. You got your mulching head already hooked up to your skid loader, and Josh is on the way up there to film it. It's going to be really interesting to hear the feedback from everyone at the show about a very and our habitat projects are completely different. But using this technology, I think, is going to be a game changer for both of us moving forward.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I'm excited to climb on that skidder tomorrow and fire up that machine and get that mulching head working. I've never run one before. I was tempted to go out before this filming starts, but I want to do kind of an intro for this video that's going to be produced, and I want to be standing there in front of a brand new machine. I mean, the teeth still have the paint on them and everything. And then we're going to fire it up and put it to work. You know, folks that listen to us hear us talk about freedom of human intrusion. And you know, we talk about in the spring, once it greens up, you need to stay out. I want everybody to realize, because if I don't say this, we're going to get some comments about it, I'm sure. I'm not going into my sanctuary with this thing. My sanctuary is off limits. And I think I probably have not done a very good job of fully explaining the freedom of human intrusion. I mean, we're planting food plots. I'm mowing my clover, my fire breaks, around my switchgrass and things like that. But I'm totally staying out of the sanctuary, the bedding cover. And on this project that I'm going to be doing with this mulcher, I'm going to be going through a small wooded area, but it's not my sanctuary. This is a little piece off of the new 40 that I bought a couple years ago. Austin Razor and I went in there. Well, actually, Austin did most of it. I was just in there watching. He did a heavy TSI cut a couple winters ago, or actually it was a spring ago, so it's been about a year and a half now. But the sunlight has come in, and when Austin got done, we cleared a path. It's a long, narrow strip of woods. It's not very wide. It follows a creek, surrounded by ag fields, but we cleared a path so the deer could stay in the cover. But the sunlight's in there now, and it's just growed up, I mean, just gnarly thick. And what I'm going to do is go in with this mulching head, and I'm just going to open that trail. And I'm not going to be cutting down trees or anything like that, but it's going to be a bunch of saplings, and there's some bush honeysuckle and things like that. And I'm just going to go through with that machine and get that trail open back up. And, you know, hopefully I'll have that machine forever. And I've got some other projects next winter that I'm going to do in my sanctuary. And I'll probably wait till spring, right at green up or right before green up, when the deer started to disperse, give them a chance to winter here and not be disturbed. But then I've got another property I want to do a project on. So I can't wait to put that FAE head to work.
So I ran, we had three different heads on my property today. And I'm telling you what, the newest technology of this FAE head, I've never seen anything like it. So for those of you who are trying to figure out how to get, basically, we're going to do a seminar at the Midwest Sportsman's Classic in February 2026 that showcases how we're using forestry heads for our deer hunting. And for those of you who don't know, the Midwest Sportsman's Classic is going to be February 18th and 21st. So all of you guys who have been saying that you didn't want it the same week as NWTF or the National Farm Machinery Show, the crew that runs the show listened, and it's a week later this year, the 19th through the 21st. Mark your calendars. You're going to be able to see this exclusive. We got drone footage. We're going to have aerials. Don and I are going to get up and talk about how we're using and manipulating the habitat to do different things with deer on both of our properties. So I'm really excited about that. While everybody was in, a couple of the Chasing Giants guys that filmed for the TV show came in. They were all running different camera angles. We put a bunch of footage together. So we put up the new Novix Raider ladder stand and did a review on it. It's going to be on Chasing Giants TV. We did a Wise Eye camera video. We did a Coonless feeder video. But Don, I'm most excited. Merle Fisher, Mark wasn't able to come, but Merle ended up coming. And we put up my Chasing Giants edition 360 blind in this spot that I've been laying out for 2 years. This is 2 years in the making, and I'm going to put a picture up right now for those who are watching on YouTube. I have never been more excited about a hunting spot that I've created in my life. It's going to be my equivalent to the smoky blind on your property. It's going to be a game changer for me, but it's taken me 2 years to just set it up to get it ready.
Yeah, I've got a couple new spots on my farm too. Two of them, 360 blinds on them. Another one's just got a ladder stand, but never stopped getting better. And no. You might have seen the pictures I posted on social media this week of the deer using my new creek crossing. And I'm telling you what, those deer were using that crossing before I even had it done. When I was, I had a bunch of giant riprap brought in so it didn't wash around the giant culvert that I put up, and I'll send you some pictures to put on the screen for people watching this. But it was just crazy that the deer, before it was even done, are already crossing there. And well, we got it done, and I went and put a camera up, and I'm telling you, less than 24 hours after putting that camera up, I had bucks, multiple bucks crossing that, as well as does, but one pretty nice buck that I posted there on social media, and I'll send it to you, Terry, so you can post it here. But that is going to be one dynamite spot. Those deer were crossing that creek in about six different spots, and I've got that all funneled down to one major crossing. And the great thing about it is on one side of that creek is bedding cover, great bedding cover, and on the other side is a food plot. So to get from the bedding to the food, that crossing is absolutely the way most of the deer are going to do it. I'm telling you, 95%+ are going to cross there, and I'm going to be able to hunt it with a south wind. The deer are going to be able to cross in the afternoon with the wind in their face coming into that food. It just sets up absolutely perfect.
Yeah. So, again, a lot of this is going to be documented on Chasing Giants TV. A lot of this is going to be documented and tied together in Shipshawana this year. So we appreciate you guys following all of our stuff. And, I don't know. I guess when you see this vision, I had multiple people on my farm this week that hadn't been on my farm in like four or five years. And they walked on my farm and they said, this doesn't even look like the same place. That's the biggest compliment to me, because I had a vision 4 years ago about how I wanted to do this. And now all the final stages are being put together. Yeah, just pay attention to Chasing Giants TV on YouTube. You're going to get to be able to see a lot of it, and really excited to share that with each of you, and exclusive content at the Shipshawana Show with our friends at FAE, and you'll be using that mulcher head for the first time here this weekend. So a lot of cool footage. Josh got so much drone footage of our place this week. It was really neat. We're going to put all that together. We even did, you talk about puckering up. I texted you either yesterday or 2 days ago, and we were getting ready to film. We needed to film one segment to produce the King David hunt. Several people have commented recently about when we're going to air this hunt, and we needed to film just a couple minutes of a narrative on this about something unique that this buck was doing. And I literally, Don, thought I lost all the footage. I even texted you and said, what's the chances you still have this on your SD card? I about was sick to my stomach this week thinking that I lost all that footage.
Well, if you didn't, I had you covered, because I found it. So,
yeah.
Erased it.
Anyway, we're going to be filming a lot of that stuff and finishing that up. Hunt videos start this month on Chasing Giants TV. We got Joe Bosing from Indiana with some early season hunts that we're going to show, and then we'll have some every month through hunting season. So check that out. Let's move on to the 360 Blinds Higgins hot seat. And this is going to, I'm not sure where this is going to go with you, Don. And I got to be a little bit honest that I'm asking this question as a biased person, because I kind of want you to answer a certain way. I hope you do. But I have to be honest about something that happened probably 18 or 19 years ago. And that is when we first met. I've never even told you this story. When we first met and I knew you had just killed your big 214 and all of that, I didn't know you from Adam, right? We'd never, until that Illinois Deer Show, the first time we walked up and actually talked, when you had your tree farm business there, you had a booth there and had the buck at the show, I just had heard about you. But when, man, I even hate saying this. I hope you don't get mad at me for saying it. When I heard that you had a captive deer herd, I kind of turned my nose up at you at first. Because I'm like, oh, no wonder, you know, because it's just this generalization, right? People got a captive deer herd, they kill big bucks. You know, you automatically think something dirty. As I saw your farm, it all made sense. As I've gotten to know you, it all makes sense. So I think one of the things that maybe our listeners who've never had a chance to go to your master class, they don't subscribe to Whitetail Master Academy, as you look at your farm from an aerial view today, I would really like you to talk about when you raise captive deer, where was it on your farm? Where were the high fences at that you kept these bucks in? And how did it relate to your hunting property, your sanctuary, your food plots, and all that? And then how is it today? How do you utilize that space? Because if there's a listener out there that doesn't understand your property, they've never seen the aerials that have been on Whitetail Master Academy or your hunting videos, they might just say, well, he had a high fence operation and raised captive deer long time ago, and he just still hunts inside of that. I don't want that generalization to be in everybody's mind. So can you just walk through your farm and where those buck pens were and how you utilize that space today, how it affects your hunting property, if anything? I don't know. Maybe we'll get on a tangent with this. I don't know if we will or not, but it's been on my mind recently.
Well, it's a topic that there's a couple of people who maybe three or four people that have tried to exploit the fact that I've once had captive deer and have started rumors that are absolutely not true. I probably should just start at the beginning just to, you know, share the full story. So I first got captive deer back in, I was probably in my early to mid 30s, crazy about deer hunting, just like I am today. I just wanted to learn as much as I could about whitetails and become the best deer hunter that I possibly could. And I was reading a magazine, and there was a ad in the back, just a little tiny ad that some guy was selling whitetail fawns, and he was in Illinois. And so I gave the guy a call, and that next weekend, my wife and my girls were real tiny at the time. One was I know she wasn't old enough to be in school, my youngest one, but we all packed in the car and on a Saturday, and we drove across the state. It was in western Illinois, the other side of the state, and visited with this guy, and he had a captive herd of, I don't know, I'm going to guess there was probably 50 or so deer, and I'd never heard of people raising captive deer back then. I mean, we're talking 30 years ago, before that whole industry blew up and became what it is today. And I just thought it was neat, the things that I was seeing on that visit. Vocalizations that I was hearing these deer make. You was seeing the hierarchy, the pecking order. I mean, the guy was telling me that this is the boss doe, and just watch her. She does what she wants, but these other does, they may come up close, but they know their space or their limit and all that. And well, that really got me to thinking. And I don't know, it was probably, I don't know, a year or so later, I learned about a local family that was raising deer and ended up buying two doe fawns from them. And, you know, my whole purpose, again, was to learn more about whitetails and just be as knowledgeable as I could, learn things that I could take to the deer woods to make me a better hunter. And so I ended up having those deer for about 20 years, give or take. And in 2017, the last of those deer left the farm, And, you know, one rumor that's went around is that when I got rid of my deer, I opened the gate and turned all the does loose. Well, that's absolutely not true at all. There was not a single doe turned loose. In fact, I can give you the names of the two gentlemen who bought my entire doe herd, local guys from Moultrie County. If anybody is interested, I don't want to mention their names because I don't have their permission to mention their names, but every doe on my farm went to those two guys. All my bucks went to a farm in southern Illinois. So the deer that you're seeing on my farm today don't have anything to do with the captive deer that were once there. So I got rid of them in 2017, but I had these pens, you know, high fence pens already up. And what I did was I basically just converted those deer pens into cattle pasture. So where my cattle are today is where those deer used to be. And I just, you know, I thought, why tear this fence down and then build a shorter one just for the cows? This tall fence will hold the cows in just as well. So my cattle pasture, if you drive by on the road and you look at it, you're going to see some of that high fence. And that's, well, two things. Part of that, where that cattle pasture is today, was the deer pens, and the other part was a tree nursery. And I put that high fence around the tree nursery to protect those trees from the deer getting in there and destroying them. So I know people drive by and they see that some of that high fence around my cattle pasture, and they're wondering, why has he got that high fence there today? And it was just a matter of leaving it so I didn't have to rebuild a cattle fence. But, you know, there's some people, I hesitate. I want to keep this as positive as can be. There's some people that like to spread rumors regarding high fences and turning loose captive deer. And, you know, one of those guys is fighting demons, the likes of which I can't even comprehend. He's got some serious issues. I literally pray for the guy all the time. Whenever I hear that he said something else about me, I just pray for him because he's dealing with something that I can't even imagine. There's a couple other guys that have hunted on my farm. They know that some of the things they're saying are not true. They're trying to say things like, well, his farm is, he's got this area surrounded by a high fence with one little opening, and when the deer come and go out of that opening, that's where he stands at, and he shoots them as they come and go. Absolutely, there is no place on my farm where the deer don't have at least five or six options as far as escape routes. I've had people ask me, do I regret ever having those captive deer because of all the crap I take because of it? And not really, because I learned so much. You know, I actually got to the point where I was doing experiments with the feed and minerals. I was doing experiments with genetics, doing artificial insemination with some of my does with different bucks from all around the country. And I'd learned so much. I would never be the deer manager that I am today. My property would not be where it is today had it not been for that 20-some years of raising captive deer. So I don't regret it. What I regret is that people just assume things, whether they're true or not, because they heard somebody say it. And, you know, I'm not going to get into some pissing match with some guy on the internet because he said something that's not true. On this farm, you know, I had my master class for a number of years. The last year that I had it, we had 150 students from 26 different states on this farm. They seen the cattle
walking
pasture
through that
where the
pasture.
High
we Absolutely. Walked through the pasture.
Yeah, we walked right in, right through a gate with the high fence, and they seen how the farm lays out. So I have never tried to hide the fact that I had captive deer. I have never tried to hide the fact that I mean, there's no way of hiding that fence. I mean, you can see it from the road. Anybody that drives by my house and sees my cows is going to see that high fence that surrounds three sides of that cow pasture. But yeah, so the wooded area where I hunt today was never part of a deer pen. It just wasn't.
Your sanctuary.
The deer were in that, right. They're in that pasture area. So it is what it is, and people are going to believe what they want. But there's enough people out there that know the truth that there's no sense in, you know, me getting into some verbal spat.
I didn't
with
want
somebody.
This to get into a pissing match, like you said, but I think back at my first, when I heard that you had it, and I was guilty of kind of turning my nose up until I got to know you. I thought it was just a cool topic to talk about your farm and that the pastures that you had the deer in when you had them, that's used for your cattle, your sanctuary, your food plots, your switchgrass, all of that is the same as it was even prior to you having it. There's none of that that's really changed. You've actually expanded the other side of the farm and grown it. But there where your old home site was, where you lived for years, your deer pen was your backyard, basically. I mean, you didn't have much of a yard. It was pasture for you. So I don't know. I just, maybe the listeners don't care and don't want us talking about it. I just thought it was a cool topic that we hadn't talked about before on the podcast is, you know, that area that you used your captive deer, what do you use that area for today? And that's to raise your cattle. So as your grandson gets further along in that, you never know. You might have to expand that cattle operation in that pasture a little bit, give up some tillable, right?
Well, there's a good chance we might expand the cattle operation, but it's not going to expand into my deer hunting areas. We'll find some places for more cows, but it's not going to be in the deer woods. That's for sure. But, you know, I got to say something before we get off this topic. I appreciate the fact that you just flat out asked the question instead of assuming something that wasn't true. And I see these comments on social media or wherever. I hear somebody talking about it behind my back or whatever. Just come out and ask. I've got nothing to hide. Like I said, we had years of students walking right through the place. So there's nothing to hide. It's just a lot of nonsense, I guess, from people that have issues, whatever the issues are. And I'm not perfect by any means, but that's one thing that I certainly didn't do.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's take a break and listen to Midwest Land Group. We got some exciting projects coming up with these guys. They're rapidly expanding easterly into Kentucky, Ohio, several states. If you're looking for job opportunities or property, reach out to Midwest Land Group. These are hunters that know how to sell and find deer properties for you. So we'll be right back with the first listener submitted question.
Does your real estate agent know the difference between a rub and a scrape? Or did they ask how many deer you caught this year? At Midwest Land Group, our agents evaluate the land the way serious hunters do, because it's exactly who we are. From surveys, soil types, floodplains, and easements, to timber quality, tree stands, access, and food plots. Whether you're interested in buying or selling, work with an agent who speaks your language. Visit MidwestLandGroup.com to connect with one today. Midwest Land Group. Buyers, sellers, land. Connected.
All right, our first question comes from Isaac from Coldwater, Michigan. He says, "Hi, Don and Terry. I am a newer listener over the last few months, and I'm really enjoying the podcast. Thanks for all you guys do. I own a small hunting property in southern Michigan, and in the future I want to buy a second small hunting property. Here is my question. In your opinion, how far from the first property would the second property need to be in order for me to be hunting two different groups of bucks? Just for a little more context, I am trying to kill 2.5-year-olds and bigger, and I want to increase my odds. I have an opportunity to buy a second small piece that is about a mile away from my current farm, but I am concerned that I will be hunting many of the same bucks. Ideally, I want to be hunting two mostly separate groups of bucks. How many miles should I try to separate the properties to achieve my goals?" Well, Isaac, I think a mile is a little bit too close. Ideally, I think you'd want to be about 3 miles away, and that's going to vary some depending on the terrain. And in open ag country where I live, it's going to be those bucks are going to travel a little bit farther on average. And you get bucks everywhere that travel more than other bucks. So I'm just you know, throwing out some general thoughts. Depending on how heavily the area is timbered around you and such, I'd want to stay at least 3 miles, and I think 5 would be better. I mean, there's just a lot of factors that come into play, but, you know, what surrounds your property. You could have some things where deer never go one direction. You know, I don't know, some major river, and I know deer will swim even the widest river, but a major river is going to stop a lot of deer traffic back and forth. It won't stop at all, but it'll stop a lot of it. An interstate highway, it's not going to stop a lot of, or all of it by any means, but it'll stop some of it and things like that. But I think you need to to look at least 3 miles, and 5 would be better.
Yeah. We've talked about this on the podcast before, depending on the topography, the amount of wooded cover, you know, in some areas out by you, or say out by in Kansas, there's areas out there where you have to go 4 miles to get to the next woodlot. I mean, it's a long way across some of those open ag fields where you get a bunch of draws and hollers of Southeast Ohio, like where the property you're trying to sell is, that you just put on the market. It's a lot different.
Yeah, for sure. So I've got a property in mind that I would like to purchase. It's not for sale. And if I get in a financial position where I can approach the landowner, I think it lays out absolutely ideal for growing giants like I do here at home. That property, well, I probably shouldn't say, or I'll have everybody jumping on Onyx to see exactly how many miles. You know, they'll be doing a radius around my farm to see if they can figure it out. Well, let's just say it's less than 10 miles from my house, and maybe it's too close, maybe it's just right, but I probably shouldn't even say what I did.
The right property is the right property. I don't know that I would, you know, he's asking whether it's the same group of bucks. If it's a property that has great access and, you know, nobody hunting the property lines, and, you know, don't worry about whether you're hunting the same bucks or not, because you're going to be able to kill the biggest, baddest, oldest buck there. The right property is the right property.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
While we're talking about,
you might find one a mile away that's better than yours.
Right. While we're talking about properties, while I get the second question ready, do you want to talk a little bit about your Ohio property? I kind of mentioned it, but we didn't really talk about it earlier.
Yeah, I mentioned it a week or two ago at the very tail end of a podcast, and I want to mention it again. I had a lot of interest in, but nobody's made an offer yet. So my partner and I have a property in Scioto County, Ohio, 75 acres. We bought a couple of years ago and totally developed it. Austin Razor has done some work on it. He's got the food plots, 2 food plots of about approximately 4 acres each. There's 2 360 blinds, there's 2 feeders, and there's a water hole, a clover strip, ladder stand. It's ready to hunt right now. The plots have been planted, ready to hunt this fall. 75 acres, Scioto County, Ohio. I mentioned it first on the podcast like I did the last time before I put it out there on social media. I'm going to be putting that on social media within a week or so, but I wanted our podcast listeners to have a first chance at that property if they want. And my partner's been running trail cameras on it this summer, and we've got some decent bucks on there right now. No giants, just to be honest, but got bucks in the 150 range. Nobody has hunted the property at all for the last 2 years. They had a bad EHD outbreak there right before we bought it, and we thought, well, it's going to take us a couple of years to get it developed anyway. We'll just develop it, not hunt it, and by the time we're ready to sell it, there ought to be some up-and-comers, and that's what we got right now. So reach out to me if you have any interest in that.
All right. Here you go. Number 2.
Next question comes from Hunter Miller from New Philadelphia, Ohio. Says, hello, Don and Terry. I have a question about food plots. I know that you love the Deadly Dozen mix, but would planting the plot topper and harvest salad in separate plots yield better results? I have heard others say never to mix plant types such as oats or rye with brassicas. If you had a smaller property of 40 acres with 5 acres of tillable land, would it be more beneficial to do 2 acres of plot topper, 2 acres of harvest salad, and 1 acre of clover, or 4 acres of Deadly Dozen and 1 acre of clover? I would love to hear your thoughts on this. Thanks. Well, Hunter, I've done it both ways, and to be honest, I like to plant them together, and the reason for that is those bulb plants, the turnips and the radish and such that's in the plot topper, they all need space to grow. And that space around those plants could be filled in with cereal grains really nice. If those two products, the plot topper and harvest salad, if they are planted at the correct rates, it's just good for both. The brassicas have plenty of room to put those big bulbs on. The cereal grains fill in around those, and it just gives you the best of both worlds. I'll tell you what, there is so much information on the internet anymore. New seed companies popping up every week. New video groups popping up with their advice, and There's some good stuff out there, but there's just a lot of stuff I just totally disagree with. And this is one thing I disagree with. I think you're way better off just to put them all in one plot. And now I'll tell you, there is one advantage to separating them. And the advantage is creating better hunting patterns with your deer movement. So early in the year when the temperatures are warm, those deer are going to be hitting those cereal grains harder, the oats, the rye, things like that. And then when you get into the winter months and the late season, they're going to be hitting the brassicas. And you can concentrate your hunting efforts early around those cereal grains and later around those brassicas and maybe put yourself in a better position to kill a good buck.
I don't know if I hope the person who submitted the question doesn't take this the wrong way, because I don't mean it that way. But if he's got this many acres of, I would put more spring product and complement it with fall product. I don't know his deer density. I don't know the layout, but you know, he's talking about a lot of acreage, and maybe there's row crop in there or not, but you know, he was talking about 4-5 acres in there. Cause I think, what do you say? 2 acres a plot top or 2 acres a harvest salad, and then an acre, that's 5 acres. You know, I would, depending on deer density, possibly even, why isn't there a spring, you know, grain in there, and using the fall products to kind of complement it versus all of it. But there might be other stuff to the story. And I don't mean to, Hunter, I appreciate the question. I don't mean it to be critiquing your plan in any way, but that's a lot of acreage to put just in fall plot.
Yeah, if that was mine, I'd have 5 acres of soybeans, and I'd come in the fall and I would put a deadly dozen around the edge.
Yeah.
You know, out 20, right, 30 feet or so.
Okay. There's always more to the story that we don't know. We get that.
Right.
Here's the next question.
This one comes from Cliff Goitowski from Grafton, Ohio. It says, hi, Don and Terry. Thank you for the extremely educational podcast. I watch them every week, and they sure make me rethink how I manage my land and hunt. I have seen where a guy is doing some testing on various types of corn, soybeans, sunflowers, and other plants for food plots. One of the corn types is NutriCrave corn. According to his test results, the NutriCrave corn and the other corns have a higher protein and phosphorus content than the soybeans in the early stages of growth. Additionally, there appears to be significant browsing pressure on the corn stalks and leaves in addition to the soybeans. It has always been my belief that deer generally prefer green soybean plants over green corn plants and would not touch the corn plants if there were soybeans readily available. Can you provide any insight on this matter? Have you seen heavy deer browsing on corn plants? Well, Cliff, I absolutely have seen them browse corn plants very heavily. I cannot tell you why. Obviously, there's something in that corn plant that they crave and they need, probably a micronutrient. I have never done an analysis on corn leaves, so I have no idea how they compare to soybeans. I know soybeans are very high in protein. We have done plenty of analysis on soybean leaf, but I've seen a couple of different tests that people have done using NutriCrave corn, and it's almost like these tests were done to basically discredit NutriCrave. And you know, they're trying to draw conclusions from these corn tests here at the 1st of August, because they've already produced, here we are at the 8th of August, and these folks have already produced videos that are out. What does it matter what a corn plant has right now? We're growing this corn for the winter months when the deer need it the most. And one guy made an observation on his trial that the other corn that he was testing against NutriCrave produces so much more grain because he's got 4 ears on every stalk, and the NutriCrave only had 1, maybe 2. Well, folks, I'm here to tell you that comment shows how little that guy knows about corn. Because there is no ag company out there trying to breed for 4 ears on a stalk. Farmers know that one big ear on a stalk is going to produce more grain than multiple small ears. And they're just drawing conclusions, first of all, at a time when they shouldn't even be looking at the crop yet, maybe observing it. But as far as drawing conclusions, it's way too early to draw conclusions. We've said it before. We've never tried to hide the fact that NutriCrave, the nutrient content raises in that plant as that stalk dries down. So if you would go out and pull a grain sample when that corn first starts to harden on the ear, the nutrient content is not going to be near as good as if you let that corn stalk totally dry down. Go out there in the 1st of December when the deer really need that corn the most and pull your analysis sample then and compare it with something, you know, some other brand of corn then. And that's right. When you should see the difference. And I'm all for people trialing things. I mean, we do it every year. You and I right now, Terry, are trialing two different corns against NutriCrave. We're always looking for something better. And I certainly don't blame anyone else for trying to find something better as well. But you got to do the tests. You got to be fair about the test, and you got to do it with some common sense. And to be looking at a corn crop and drawing conclusions at the 1st of August is just a terrible way to do a corn trial.
Well, I'm going to clarify a statement with this, because I sent you three ears. Did you get those three ears that I sent to you?
I did. I sent them to Dwayne. I did not even look at them. I didn't chuck them.
So here's the thing. I sent Don a ear of NutriCrave, randomly picked NutriCrave, and one ear from each of our test plots. The thing that I'm looking at right now is the yield. That's the only thing you should be looking at right now is how many kernels, how many bushels an acre do we estimate that this, you know, because, you know, we've talked about how much of a great year this corn crop is. I got corn ears that are like 14, 15 inches tall. And that's an observation we can make right now. But from a tissue analysis side, no, we're not even talking that until it dries down. So there's actually, by the time people see this, there's going to be, I think it's the same day that this one airs, there's a social media post scheduled for Sunday on the Real World channel about when you're testing this stuff in the tissue analysis, giving you a little bit more education about what goes into all of that. So make sure you check out the Real World social media pages, and you'll learn more about, if you're doing these side-by-side testing, give you a little insight there.
And we encourage that side-by-side testing. It's we all want to get better at what we do. And if there's something better out there, by golly, I want to be planting it on my farm too. So it's just how some of these tests are done. Anyway, let's move on. Next question comes from James Phipps from Waynetown, Indiana. He says, "Hello, Don and Terry. Appreciate the podcast and all the knowledge you share. Ever since you guys started the podcast, my hunting has went to a whole new level. My question is, when hunting in ag country, I know you don't like hunting October mornings, but when the time is right in November, what's your advice to access stands where you have to walk across open fields to get to your stand on the edge of timber?" Well, James, I do that all the time. That describes how I access almost every morning stand I hunt. I'm coming across an open field. And the way to do it is you just walk with the wind straight in your face right to your stand, in the dark with no light. And if you bump deer with no light and you're just walking, I don't think they're going that far. It's not like you're blowing them out to the next county. Get in a half hour before daylight and get in your stand and just go right across that open field.
Well, in that time of the year, we're going across the open field to hunt the downwind side of bedding area, which those deer are going to be working the entire time that you're in the stand. So it's not like you're doing it for early season hunting where you're hunting, you know, the edge of a food plot, or if you will. We're going across to open ag to go to the downwind side of a bedding area, which they should be burning up if we're getting any rut activity at all.
Yep.
All right, we got time for one more. Let's squeeze one more in here, Don.
Okay, this one comes from Jeremiah Johnson from Springfield, Tennessee. He says, "Dear Don and Terry, my question is, if you were drawn and going to hunt Kansas public land for your first time ever this season and have no prior intel on any deer in the unit you were going to hunt, how would you go about finding, targeting, hunting, and just making the most out of your time in Kansas hunting whitetail. This will be my first ever trip to Kansas hunting whitetail, and while I'm anxious, I'm also nervous due to never being there before and only having 10 days off of work to figure out the layout and try to get on a mature buck to harvest. Any and all ideas are appreciated. Thank you all for y'all do for this great sport we call hunting, and God bless y'all for the for all the amazing things being done through Lester's feet and the outdoor community in general. Thank you sincerely, Jeremiah Johnson, just like the mountain man. Well, Jeremiah, if I had drawn a tag for Kansas or Iowa or any place like that, I'm already out there at this point. I'm already out there putting trail cameras out. I'm probably trying to find a bigger buck than the average hunter, and I'm out there covering some territory. I'm putting cameras any place and every place that I can get permission, public land, private land, doesn't matter. Whatever unit I'm planning on hunting in, I've got cameras all over that place to find a target buck. I want to know when I go out there that there's a buck that I would shoot if he come by my stand, and not just going out on a hope and a prayer after season's open. You got only got 10 days. That makes it even more critical. You cannot wait and then show up in the middle of November and think that you've got a reasonable chance to kill a giant or even, you know, a good buck in 10 days. Yeah, it can happen. It happens every year to a lot of guys, but there's a lot of guys that go on these trips that come home disappointed because they got no chance at all at the buck they'd been dreaming about. And especially you get in a state like Iowa where it takes so long to draw a tag. You know, I've been putting in for preference points for Iowa, but I'm telling you what, I'm not going back to Iowa until I have a target buck. And I don't want to draw a tag and then be searching for my target buck. I want to have a target buck and then draw my tag, because to be honest, as old as I'm getting, I'm probably only going to Iowa. I'm probably only drawing one more Iowa tag and then I'm done. And the only reason I'm drawing one more is because I've already got, I think, 4 preference points now. And I might as well just go ahead and keep getting preference points until I find my giant and then go hunt him. Got some leads on some properties out there through a listener of the podcast, actually, that I've met with, and he's invited me several times to come to these farms that he's got access to. And when I know that I'm close to having the preference points to draw a tag, I'm going to be out there in the spring, post-season scouting, looking for sheds, finding stand locations, and that I'm going to go back in the summer. I'm going to hang trail cameras on every possible property that I can. I'm talking public land, private land. It doesn't matter. If I can get access, I'm going in and putting some cameras up. And then when it comes time to hunt, I'm going to have a reasonable chance of success. I don't think the odds are near as good as if it happens here where I live, where I can pick and choose my days. And when the wind and the weather conditions are right, I go hunting. When they're bad, I stay home. When you get out that far from home, you're not going to sit in a motel room. You need options for every wind direction and such, but you're still limited on how many days you're going to be there. And even, I don't care if you don't have any job at all, you're still, it's still not like hunting from home. So you need to do your homework early. And if you haven't done anything yet, you got 2 strikes against you.
All right. Well, great questions this week. Don, be safe running that mulching head this week and have fun with that. We got a big week ahead of us with different projects and different traveling going on. If you stay tuned to the end of this podcast right now, Daryl Monk, one of the owners of Wise Eye, is going to do our Sunday night prayer time. We hope you stick around for that. And that's all I got, man. I'm honestly kind of tired. We've worked hard the last couple of days filming all this content. I'm ready to go to bed.
Well, I'm ready to check some more cameras and find a giant. I've still got several cameras that I've not checked for the first time yet this year, and I don't have anything to get me excited. Now, it's kind of disappointing. I was really fired up at the 1st of July when I was putting all these cameras out, but that's the way it goes some years. This might be a year that I shoot cull bucks and make my farm better for next year.
Yep. Always a process. All right. Yep. Thanks, everybody.
God bless everyone. See you next week.
Chasing Giants has been brought to you by Osseo Camo. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for another episode of Chasing Giants.